KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, the latest on the Minnesota shootings that killed a state lawmaker and wounded another. Also, updates on the continued attacks between Israel and Iran. Plus, could affordable housing also help the fight against climate change?
On the federal level, the government is backtracking on climate action and proposing big cuts to public housing. But on the local level, there already are examples of green social housing popping up.
And 400 laid off CDC workers are now being asked to come back. It's Sunday, June 15th. Happy Father's Day. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. A manhunt continues for the suspect in the shootings of two Minnesota state lawmakers and their spouses. 57-year-old Vance Luther Belcher is the suspect. Two of the four victims, State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, are dead. U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota told ABC News this morning.
What we know from the list of the fact that we had groups like Planned Parenthood on the list, some of the things we know about the manifesto, this was clearly politically motivated. It was an assassination.
State Senator John Hoffman and his wife remain hospitalized. A Washington, D.C. parade marking the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary unfolded late yesterday without incident. Heavy rain held off. There was no violence, with President Trump concluding the U.S. should celebrate its military like other countries do. Elsewhere, in multiple locations across the country, there were protests. In Atlanta, thousands gathered in front of the state capitol there, with hundreds turned away due to size limitations. NPR's Brian Mann reports on one protest in rural Vermont.
These protests are happening in big cities across the United States, but they're also happening in tiny rural towns. I'm in Vergennes, Vermont, and there is just a huge crowd packed along the main street here, waving American flags, holding signs that say we have a constitution, not a king, king free since 1776. One of the people I spoke with was Ellie Wilkinson Sachs. She's 17 years old.
I think we need more love in this country and less hate. I don't agree with where money is going or the legal actions that are being taken. I think it's something that a king would do, and I don't think that we should have a king in America. That's why we founded it.
All of the people here say they're frightened by the direction President Trump is taking the country. Brian Mann, NPR News, Vergennes, Vermont.
Israel's emergency services say at least 10 people have been killed by the latest Iranian missile attacks in central and northern parts of the country. The Israeli military also carried out further strikes on Tehran, targeting oil depots and buildings linked to Iran's military and nuclear program. Iranian authorities say the total number of civilian casualties is still unknown. The BBC's Hugo Bechega reports from Bat Yam, Israel, which was hit overnight.
I think there is shock here because of the scale of the destruction, the scale of what happened here. I think there's also fear because many people have been telling us that they believe that they were protected. This is a country that has a very sophisticated air defense system. And what we're seeing here is that not only here, but in other parts of the country, missiles have managed to penetrate these very sophisticated, strong protection, with the authorities warning that they are expecting more attacks like this.
This is NPR News. In Ahmedabad, India, search and recovery efforts continue in the aftermath of an Air India crash Thursday. At least 270 are known dead after the jet fell from the sky shortly after takeoff and onto a medical college hostel. One passenger survived with relatively minor injuries and remains hospitalized. The aircraft's black box has been recovered and is being analyzed. A small town in England is suffering from a plague of peacocks. Vicky Barker reports from London.
When the Marshall Fire tore through Louisville, Colorado in 2021, it destroyed entire neighborhoods. Afterwards, neighbors Ann Brennan and Lisa Hughes rebuilt their homes to be more fire resistant. It's called home hardening. They installed fine metal mesh over vents to block embers, and they cleared anything flammable like mulch and trees from near their homes. Fire expert Kimiko Barrett is with the research group Headwaters Economics. She says many of these changes are within reach.
We do know that many of the most effective home hardening risk reduction strategies are also the most affordable.
Brennan and Hughes worked with their neighbors. Now, their community has a 3-year action plan to prepare for future fires. For NPR News, I'm Ishan Takor in Louisville, Colorado.
The Consumer Product Safety Commission is calling attention to the recall of more than 1 million power banks from the China-based Anker Innovations. Certain PowerCore 10,000 power banks pose the risk of fires and explosions. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. A suspect in a shooting of 2 Minnesota lawmakers continues to evade law enforcement this morning. Vance Belter is suspected of shooting and killing former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark. And he's suspected of shooting Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette, who are both recovering after surgery. Both lawmakers are Democrats. Joining us now is Catherine Richard of Minnesota Public Radio News. Hi, Catherine.
Hello, Aisha.
So what's the latest on the search for Belter?
Law enforcement says they believe he's armed and dangerous, and they're encouraging anyone who thinks they've spotted him to call 911. The FBI is also offering a $50,000 reward for information leading to Belter's arrest. Now, we also know that Belter was posing as law enforcement. He was wearing a vest with a taser and a badge that looked similar to one that a police officer would wear. In one image captured on a Ring camera, he appears to be wearing a mask that makes him look bald. And then in another shot, he was wearing a cowboy hat.
What are authorities looking into in terms of the suspect's background?
You know, law enforcement says they found what they describe as a manifesto in a vehicle Belter left behind with a list of individuals who were targeted. Also in the vehicle were leaflets that read No Kings. That's in connection to the No Kings demonstrations around the state yesterday and around the nation. He's also listed as part of a leadership team at Praetorian Guard Security, which provides armed home security in the Twin Cities area. Praetorian's website says that security officers drive, quote, police-type vehicles, wear protective equipment, and only offer armed security. The website also featured an SUV resembling a police vehicle.
There was a shelter-in-place order much of the day yesterday for Brooklyn Park, which is a suburb of the Twin Cities. Law enforcement lifted that late afternoon. What does that mean, or does that mean they're looking for Belter elsewhere?
Yeah, it appears that's the case. As of late yesterday, law enforcement were looking near Green Isle, which is a rural area southwest of the Twin Cities. And police also said they searched a Minneapolis home in connection with Belter. He rented a room there. The FBI says it's using every available resource to find him.
And how are Senator Hoffman and his wife doing?
You know, yesterday, the Hoffmans underwent surgery to treat their injuries. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz told reporters yesterday that their care providers are cautiously optimistic that they'll survive. As of late last night, Hoffman's nephew, Matt Olig, told us that his aunt Yvette Hoffman was awake, but that they were still awaiting news on his uncle. Olig described a gruesome and dramatic scene.
Someone came up dressed as a cop, shot my uncle 6 times, my aunt 5 times. Bullet narrowly missed my uncle's heart. my aunt actually, their daughter was home at the time, and my aunt threw herself on top of her, so she was uninjured, thankfully.
Representative Hortman served for 2 decades. Tell us more about her and what her colleagues at the Minnesota Capitol are saying about her.
You know, they describe her as a strong leader, someone who was able to build consensus to get bills passed even when it was challenging. She was also responsible for ushering in some key Democratic initiatives, including abortion rights, universal lunch for students, and gun restrictions. And everyone we've spoken with said Hortman was someone people admired, even her political opposites. Here's how former and longtime Republican state representative Pat Garofalo described Hortman.
A very tough day. I want to repeat Melissa Hortman. She's the opposite party from me. Melissa Hortman has gone down as the most consequential and impactful Speaker of the House in Minnesota history.
He emphasized that her kindness extended to everyone at the legislature, regardless of political party.
That's Catherine Richard of Minnesota Public Radio News. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Israeli government says it unleashed 80 more attacks on Iran overnight. Fuel depots burned, lighting the night sky bright orange. Roads out of Tehran are packed with people fleeing the capital city. In Israel, Iranian missiles appear to have evaded Israeli defense systems and destroyed a residential block. Iran was scheduled to attend the next round of nuclear talks with the U.S. later today, but those talks have been canceled. Ali Vaez is Iran Project Director for Crisis Group, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, Aisha.
Back in March, you told my colleague Scott Simon that Iran would not negotiate with the U.S. with a gun to its head. From Iran's perspective, has that trigger been pulled?
Absolutely. And that is why the Iranians have, in the past few days, noted that they will not return to the negotiating table. In fact, there was a round of negotiations that was scheduled to take place today in Oman between Iran and the U.S. And the Iranians have also said that they would stop further cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency, the U.N. nuclear watchdog. So this is a situation that has turned from bad to worse.
Have you been speaking to people inside of Iran? And if so, what are you hearing from them? Are they rallying around the regime, or do they hope that the attacks might bring down the government?
Look, Iran is a country of 90 million, and there's diversity and a range of views inside the country. There are some who hate this regime and are happy if it comes down at any price, even if the price is the destruction of the entire country. And there are core constituents and supporters of the regime who are now much more zealously committed to trying to preserve it. And then I would say there are the majority of the people in between who blame their own government, but also blame Israel for striking Iran and targeting civilians. So there is really a range of views. But what we have seen on the street so far hasn't been any protest against the regime, but rather protests and rallying around the flag.
Israel has also been launching airstrikes on Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, in addition to bombing Gaza and the West Bank. Does Israel have any regional support for these attacks on Iran?
It does not. In fact, the Arab Gulf states, which are now have a much better relationship with Iran and have de-escalated their own tensions with Iran in the past few years, are extremely worried about expansion of this conflict that would basically turn them into collateral damage and undermine all of their lofty economic development plans in the next few years. And countries like Jordan and Iraq are basically sandwiched between Iran and Israel. Iranian missiles fly overhead and Israeli jets in the other direction. And so the entire region is panicked and worried about where this is going and how it will end.
Well, Israel launched its attacks on Iran, it said, to destroy Tehran's ability to build a nuclear weapon. But now that Iran is under attack from a nuclear power, does that give them more justification to develop their own nuclear weapon?
Well, it does. Iran has already paid the price economically for a nuclear weapon through years of sanctions. And now it is clear that its conventional deterrence, its defensive systems and its offensive ballistic missiles have not protected it from an Israeli strike. And its regional network has also been degraded, its partners and proxies in the region. And so it's basically left with no option other than the ultimate deterrent, which only comes in the form of nuclear weapons. But the question really is, after the dust settles after this war, how much of Iran's nuclear program remains? We know that Iran would be able to reconstitute its nuclear program. U.S. intelligence had assessed that an Israeli strike could only delay the program by a few months. But it is possible that it would be longer, by a year. But in any case, Iran still has the know-how and the capacity to reconstitute its nuclear program.
Is there something that President Trump or the U.S. could do to de-escalate this situation?
Absolutely. In fact, President Trump is the only person who can stop this and prevent it from turning into a disastrous regional conflagration by pursuing a dual-track approach. First, holding Israel back. By threatening that if Israel continues this conflict, which puts Americans in harm's way, there are 40,000 American troops in the region, there are hundreds of thousands of Americans in Israel. And he needs to basically use American leverage of saying if Israel continues, he would stop delivery of offensive weapons to Israel. And he also needs to threaten Iran, that if Iran continues this conflict, the U.S. would get directly involved. And of course, in order to bring this to a sustainable conclusion, then he also needs to put a fair, reasonable deal, nuclear deal with Iran on the table and offer it sanctions relief.
That's Crisis Group's Ali Vaez. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
President Donald Trump's second term has had a notable feature, confrontation with federal courts. From claiming dubious emergency powers, ignoring due process, criticizing judges, and suggesting those who rule against his administration get impeached, many scholars and legal experts are warning the president is stretching the rule of law to its very limit. Later today on All Things Considered, a warning from a conservative former federal judge.
This president of the United States is defying the Constitution and the laws of the United States every single day.
Tune in on the radio or by telling your smart speaker to play NPR. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. A manhunt continues for the suspect in the shootings of two Minnesota state lawmakers and their spouses, 57-year-old Vance Luther Belter. Two of the four victims, State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, are dead. State Senator John Hoffman and his wife remain hospitalized. Israel's emergency services say at least 10 people have been killed by the latest Iranian missile attacks in central and northern parts of the country. A Washington, D.C. parade marking the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary unfolded Saturday without incident. Heavy rain held off. The president declared the U.S. should celebrate its military like other countries do. Several cities saw anti-Trump protests. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. It's a split-screen moment in America right now. Here in Washington yesterday, President Trump presided over a rare military parade celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Army, which happened to fall on his 79th birthday. Meanwhile, people gathered across the country to protest what they saw as the politicizing of the military and Trump's attacks on the country's checks and balances. The protests were called No Kings. NPR's Frank Langfitt went to one of the protests and the parade, and he's here on the line with us this morning. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Aisha.
So let's start with the big picture. What was your takeaway from visiting these two events?
Yeah, I started the day in Annapolis, that's the capital of Maryland, for one of these No Kings rallies. And then I drove to the National Mall where the tanks rolled from like the Lincoln Memorial to the White House. And Aisha, I really felt like I was traveling between two different countries with their own cultures and ways of seeing the United States.
So give me some examples.
Yeah, they were completely different crowds and focused on very different things. One thing, though, is they all were very focused on being, as they saw themselves, as intensely patriotic.
America, America.
You can hear a little of this singing in front of the State House. At this No Kings protest in Annapolis, you saw a crowd mostly filled of white liberals, I think, and they brought out a George Washington reenactor. He had a white wig, and he gave this speech that Washington delivered when he gave up his military command here in 1783.
I retire from the great theater of action, and bidding an affectionate farewell to this august body under whose orders I have so long acted, I hereby offer my commission and leave all the employments of public life.
And the protesters' point, Aisha, was here's Washington voluntarily giving up military power, while they say Trump is trying to take on more military power.
You said there was an emphasis on patriotism at the No Kings event. How was that expressed?
Yeah, there was a union leader who told the crowd that they should own the flag. And at one point, the crowd chanted this.
We love America! We are America! We are...
So after that, you drive down to the National Mall in D.C. What did you find there?
It was totally different. A military festival, basically. You had this incredibly diverse crowd. People I talked to had come from Ecuador, Vietnam. They were people who'd come to the United States. Now, did Trump appear to try to project military power? There were two tanks parked in front of the grandstand. But people there were really there to celebrate the Army. I talked to a guy named Dennis Connolly. He's from Knoxville. And he was saying, you know, when he learned the parade was at the same time as Trump's birthday, he knew he had to come here.
President Trump, he's a go-getter. He's powerful. And he's kind of like those high school bullies like Charlie Kirk was saying. And I just think that's wonderful. We have to have a powerful president who's willing to push some boundaries.
And what struck me so much, Aisha, is how different Connolly's view of power was from those people we heard from earlier at the No Kings protest in Annapolis.
So Trump was a draw for Connolly. Was there a lot of visible support for the president at the parade?
You know, from what I saw, maybe 10% MAGA hats. And it really felt like people were there to see the Army and, frankly, because they love to see the tanks.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt. Thank you so much, Frank.
Happy to do it, Aisha.
President Trump leaves today for the Group of Seven, or G7, the annual meeting of leaders from seven advanced economies. This year, it's in Canada, a country Trump has antagonized by repeatedly saying he wants it to be the 51st state. The president has also placed tariffs on goods from all of the G7 nations. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben will be traveling with the president and joins us now with a preview. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning, Aisha.
So let's start with maybe the biggest international news in the run-up to the G7, the conflict between Iran and Israel. Do we know how that's going to weigh on the summit?
Well, it'll certainly be top of mind, but as you know, these G7 sessions are private. The leaders talk behind closed doors. But they will almost certainly talk about what issues this conflict raises in terms of international security, economics, and so on. But as for what the leaders might do about it, what they might even be able to agree on, well, it's not clear what that would be. The G7 has in the past played a part in international conflicts. For example, in 2024, pretty notably, they agreed to lend the interest from seized Russian assets to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. But then, first of all, that was a very different conflict. And also, Joe Biden was the U.S. president then, a guy much more of an internationalist than Trump. Trump, for his part, has clashed with fellow G7 leaders at past summits, and there's no reason to expect any different this time.
Remind us of those clashes. I was around for some of them. What happened in his first term?
Right, yes. Well, he clashed with other countries over a lot of things, over climate change, notably. He also wanted Russia back in the G7. The other nations did not want that. They also clashed over agendas, though. Under Trump, the U.S. took the position that the G7 simply tried to do too much. The Trump administration in the first term thought that tackling climate change and gender equality just constituted overreach. But most memorably, in 2018, the G7 summit ended with Trump blowing up at then-Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And Aisha, I think you were at that one for NPR, right?
I was. It was a dramatic end to the summit, just as Trump was leaving.
Right. And to remind people what happened, Trudeau gave this press conference ending the summit, and Trudeau threatened to retaliate against U.S. tariffs. Well, that made Trump angry. And as he left, he tweeted that Trudeau was dishonest and weak. And Trump also withdrew the U.S.'s approval from a joint statement or a communique that the countries had already agreed to. So really, Trump just kind of blew up the unity that they had all just tried to achieve.
Do we think there could be a repeat of that this year?
Well, at least not over a joint statement, because there will be no joint statement. According to the White House, that's something Canada wanted. Now, that's unusual, and it does matter, according to Victor Cha. He's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is a think tank here in Washington.
One is the G7 stepping back from the role that it had assumed as early as 2 years ago, when they basically said, we are the countries that need to lead. You know, now that the UN Security Council is stymied by Russia and China.
He was talking about issues, for example, like Ukraine and food security. But he added that the lack of statement this year reflects how much Trump's America First mindset and just general dislike of multilateralism has weakened the G7.
Is there something that Trump hopes to accomplish at the summit?
Well, White House officials said that he's hoping to talk about a list of topics like trade, critical minerals, and migration. Aside from that, he's going to have one-on-one meetings with the other G7 leaders. He might meet with leaders who are not in the G7 who are invited, like Volodymyr Zelensky from Ukraine, Claudia Sheinbaum from Mexico. It is a safe bet, though, that he'll be trying to negotiate on tariffs with other leaders, and that's something he'll talk a lot about when he talks to reporters.
That's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Acropole Hotel stood as a landmark in central Khartoum for 70 years, a gathering place for journalists, diplomats, and travelers. It survived coups, revolutions, and unrest, but not Sudan's latest war. Looted and abandoned, the hotel now stands as a symbol of what's been lost. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu stayed at the Acropole before the war and returned last month.
The Acropole Hotel is hard to miss. It's a grand three-story clay-colored building just a short walk away from the presidential palace. Blue wooden shutters cover the windows and patios overlook a street in central Khartoum. For decades, this was a popular landing spot for aid workers, archaeologists, and journalists visiting Sudan like it was for me 5 years ago when I stayed here. But like so much in this city, it's been wrecked by the war. The shutters and windows are broken, and parts of the walls peppered by gunfire. The hotel was founded in 1952, a few years before the 1956 celebrations marking independence from British and Egyptian rule. And after the optimism at independence came decades of civil wars, famines, military coups, and repression. The Acropole faced turbulence and was even bombed, but it stood through it all, until now. It was founded by a Greek family, the Pagulatos.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
It's nice to meet you. It's lovely to meet you.
It's nice to see you.
75-year-old Eleanor Pagulatos spoke to me on a FaceTime call from Athens.
We did very well with all the NGOs. They all stayed in the Acropole when Bob Geldof brought the Band-Aid. The only telex that was working was in the Acropole.
She lives in Greece now, but she was born and raised in Sudan.
Do you remember George, my husband?
Yes, I do. It's where she first met George Pagulatos in 1968. His father founded the Acropole, and after he died, George and his brothers took over.
He told me when he got married to me, I said, listen, my work is first. I love my work. I can't live without my... Second, it's my mother, and then come. Then you come. I said, fine. No problem.
On the call, we shared pictures of the hotel. Large photographs of pyramids and landscapes in Sudan hung on the walls, some taken by archaeologists who stayed there. Bougainvillea and aloe vera lined the patios.
I was looking after the plants. I love plants.
Yeah.
I was happy to receive those photos. Yeah. Thank you.
Like all in Sudan, the family were no strangers to unrest. So when the fighting broke out on the streets of Khartoum in April 2023, they thought it would pass.
We've been through so many coups, and we always after 4, maybe 7, 1 week, then it came back to normal.
But this time it was different. The rapid support forces took over the city and stormed in.
They just broke the door and they came in with the machine guns and asking for money and gold and water and food.
And the family were forced to leave. In March, the Sudanese army recaptured Khartoum. And last month, I went back to the Acropole to see what happened to it.
Wow. So this was the main reception area. This was the front desk. You'd go to the front desk there. And this is where the family worked from. This was their office. And it's just been completely trashed. All their documents are on the ground. The chairs broken, the tables. We've just walked into the room I stayed in when I stayed here 5 years ago, and there's no bed. The telephone line is on the floor. There were pictures on the wall. None of them are there. Only one is there, and the glass is cracked. It's just completely trashed.
For 70 years, the Acropole was more than a business for the Pagulatos.
It was a house. It was a home because we had so many nice clients, journalists, which we heard the news from them.
And especially for her husband. He never saw what happened to the hotel. He passed away a few months before the war started.
And I said, God, maybe you took him for this reason, so that he doesn't see all this, you know, because his life was the Acropole.
During the initial months of the war, she still hoped to return, but the war has continued longer than she imagined.
I loved my work, I loved the people, I loved my staff. All my life was there, all my life.
The Pagulatos family planned for their children to take over too, but not anymore.
The future of the Acropole, there is no future. You know, no one of our children wants to go back. No one.
Emmanuel Akimotu, NPR News, Khartoum.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. A tiny town in northern New York appears to have won the lottery. Long Lake is set to inherit more than $100 million from a local land deal. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell reports on what the massive windfall means for the town.
Clay Arsenal was on a Zoom call in late February when he got the news. Long Lake was named the sole beneficiary of the proceeds from a local property listed for $125 million.
I was speechless.
Arsenal is the town supervisor. The 36,000-acre property had been owned by the Whitneys for more than a century. They were one of the wealthiest families in America during the Gilded Age, and they were well-known benefactors in Long Lake. The property passed to the husband of one of the Whitneys, who bequeathed the proceeds of its sale to the town. A developer from Texas now plans to buy the land. So Arsenal is working with a team of officials and advisors on how to invest and maximize the proceeds from the sale.
We want to create generational wealth within the community. So it makes me truly excited for the future of my hometown.
This town is home to about 700 people. There's a little grocery store, a gas station, and a few other shops. From the edge of Long Lake, you can see the Adirondack Mountains rising above in the distance. This is a tourist town. It survives off the summer months when second homeowners come to play and unwind and to spend money. Paula O'Brien Perino owns the Long Lake Diner with her husband. They're closed today, so she's perched at the bar with her planner out. She was at the town board meeting when the supervisor broke the news.
It kind of felt like Christmas on steroids.
It's unclear what the net proceeds of the property sale will be, but O'Brien Perino says she's hopeful the money could make a real difference in this small Adirondack town.
We do live in the middle of paradise, but it is expensive to live here. A person moving to the Adirondack Park fresh out of college can't afford to build a home here.
Land is expensive, and good-paying jobs here are hard to find. Long Lake faces other struggles, too, like declining school enrollment and an aging population. It's that last issue that resident Barbara Kinsey is focused on. Kinsey wants to see Long Lake invest in a community health and fitness center.
When I think with my husband, should I settle here into my retirement, I think, well, I have to go this so many miles to a hospital, this so many miles for therapy, like you have to travel.
But here's the thing. Many folks who live in Long Lake love how quiet and remote it is. They like knowing their neighbors and seeing the same faces at the local bar. Some worry that tens of millions of dollars could change all that. Carol Young says those are real concerns. She manages one of the oldest businesses in town, the Adirondack Hotel.
I mean, one of the things that guests will say to me, oh my gosh, I haven't been here in 35 years, and it's just exactly how I remember it. And I think that's important for small towns, especially we're a tourist town.
As we chat, her staff is preparing for the tourist season, putting a fresh coat of paint on the porch. The owners of the Whitney property came to the hotel from time to time. Young knew them and says while the news of their estate was wonderful, it wasn't exactly shocking.
It's what people like that do for things that they love, and they loved Long Lake. And so our responsibility is to make sure that that wish is guarded into perpetuity so that, as I like to put it as an accountant, the nut stays.
It could be a year or more before Long Lake sees its potential $100 million nut. The years that follow will likely decide the fate of this small, soon-to-be-wealthy town. For NPR News, I'm Emily Russell in Long Lake, New York.
This is NPR News.
A student from Myanmar had plans to study in the U.S., but then President Trump put restrictions on travelers from nearly two dozen countries, including his. What happens now?
They told me that since I have an existing visa, I am
likely to be allowed to enter. So the keyword being likely.
Plus, we'll catch you up on the nationwide protests over the weekend on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Louise Schiavone with these headlines. President Trump leaves this evening for the Group of Seven summit in the Canadian Rockies. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has decided ahead of the gathering not to seek a joint statement from the group. Issues of trade and war are expected to lead the agenda. The New York Times reports the Trump administration has directed immigration officers to pause arrests at farms, restaurants, and hotels after the president expressed alarm about the business impact of aggressive enforcement. In Ahmedabad, India, search and recovery efforts continue in the aftermath of an Air India crash Thursday. At least 270 people are known dead. The aircraft's black box is being analyzed. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. We're wrapping up Climate Solutions Week here at NPR. This year's theme is Rethinking Home, and all week we've looked at ways our homes and communities can be more resilient and offer solutions to the changing climate. And for the week's finale here on Weekend Edition, we have NPR's Climate Solutions correspondent, Julia Simon.
Hello, Aisha. Today, I want to take you to a place that's working to combat climate change through their housing. That place is Vienna.
Vienna, Austria? You're not talking about like Vienna, Virginia.
No, Vienna, Austria.
Okay.
A few months ago, I traveled to the Austrian capital.
My hat just flew off because it's very windy.
In this big grassy park with playgrounds full of kids. There's a bunch of apartment buildings around this park, but one stands out. It's a modern building. It's got lots of wood, lots of windows. On one of the top floors, I see a guy in a beanie waving. This is Sebastian.
Schublach, if you need the full name.
Schublach works at a think tank. He's lived in this modern building for about 6 years with his wife and two young daughters. He takes us on a tour. Should we go upstairs?
Yes.
Yes, let's do it. It's six floors, lots of shared amenities.
Nice sauna.
Yeah, nice view.
With a view, yeah.
And Aisha, there are a lot of climate-friendly aspects, things that help the building reduce planet heating pollution. There are solar panels.
They're on the rooftop.
Oh, just over there. Yeah. There are cool window shades on the outside of the apartment that help keep out the sunlight and the heat in summer.
Do you mind showing us?
This all sounds really nice, but I mean, he must be paying a lot for this.
Well, for a four-bedroom, utilities included, plus the shared space, he pays about $1,700 US a month.
Which is not cheap, but it is definitely affordable.
Oh God, you don't want to know what people are paying in America.
Aisha, the whole reason we came to Vienna is because this climate-friendly apartment, it's not some fancy private apartment. It's actually subsidized by Vienna's city government. It It's something called social housing. It got going 100 years ago after World War I. There was a housing crisis and the city built thousands of apartments. So there's city-built housing and there's social housing that Shoeblock lives in. It's city-subsidized housing. Housing developers get loans and land from the city. Altogether, there's over 400,000 social housing units around Vienna, and about half the city's residents live in them, about a million people.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. And in recent years, city leaders realized that those 400,000 plus apartment units that they own or subsidize, that could help them move off fossil fuels and reach their climate goals.
So how are they doing that?
Well, let's start with the city-built housing. With the new city-built housing, it's all mandated to have solar panels. Many have efficient heat pumps. The city is also heating buildings with something called geothermal energy that involves drilling into the earth to heat homes. And the city is retrofitting old buildings. They're putting in new windows, doors, insulation.
But what about the city-subsidized housing? Like, how do they get that to be climate-friendly?
For city-subsidized housing, the city says, you housing developers, you want this land and subsidies, you got to compete for it. There's a point system for how many nice qualities the building design has. If the project has more climate-friendly aspects, then the developer gets more points to win.
So that's a lot of motivation for developers to make a climate-friendly design.
Right. There's land on the line and money on the line. And this right here, this housing competition, researchers say it's key to a lot of Vienna's innovation in climate-friendly housing. Social housing is popular in Vienna, and people around the world are noticing.
I have been absolutely inspired by Vienna's work.
This is Jung Yoon.
I'm the chief of policy for the mayor's office in Chicago.
Yoon went to Vienna last April to learn about Vienna's social housing. And there were lots of representatives from other U.S. cities on her trip.
From Nashville, from Seattle, from Philly.
She went to Shoeblock's place.
Yes, we went there. It was beautiful.
Yoon brought back lessons from Vienna to add to the work Chicago was already doing. This spring, the city of Chicago passed an ordinance that basically will help allow the city to develop and own new apartment buildings. 30% of the apartments will be affordable, and it will have regulations that reduce the energy use. And like Vienna, Chicago sees housing as a key way to reduce their climate pollution. Yoon says more than two-thirds of Chicago's greenhouse gases come from buildings. We're in a moment where on the federal level, the government is backtracking on climate action and proposing big cuts to public housing. But on the local level, there already are examples of green social housing popping up, Aisha. There's an affordable housing building in Seattle with solar panels and energy efficient air conditioning. There's an affordable housing building in Yonkers, New York. It has really high energy efficiency standards. I spoke to politicians across the country who are supporting efforts to build new apartments that are both affordable and climate friendly. And look, Aisha, there will still be people in the U.S. who want their house in the suburbs. Shoeblock in Vienna, he grew up in the Austrian countryside, which he says is like American that way.
I think it's very similar to the American dream of owning a single family house in the countryside. Yes. And the downside is that this dream for most people has become unaffordable. Some say it has become kind of a nightmare.
But Shoeblock says he's found a new dream. In his green social housing, he's found a sense of community. In his apartment building, the oldest inhabitant is almost 80 years old, and the youngest is less than a month old. They're all there for each other.
If somebody needs a banana at 8 p.m. because the kid would not eat anything else, then you get a banana within 1 minute.
And the next time there's a storm or a heat wave, because there will be a next time, Shoeblock says he will be there for his neighbors and they'll be there for him. Aisha, you know, I keep returning to this one thing this climate researcher told me. She told me in Vienna 100 years ago, they probably didn't imagine that now there would be thousands of beautiful climate-friendly apartments. They started with one building, just one building. That was their North Star.
That's NPR's Julia Simon. To see photos of the people in this story and to find more stories from Climate Solutions Week, go to npr.org/climateweek.
Every man, save a few simians, deserves freedom. The men on the other side of this field don't understand that.
Just a few pages into his new novel, and Denard Dale has written a stirring battlefield speech from a general to his troops at Gettysburg.
Right now, we can crush the Union Center and throw the continent's largest army into chaos. We can show their senators and newsmen that we will not kneel. I won't mince words. We are one charge away from winning this war, but I need you with me. Or rather, Pickett needs you with him. I'll be supervising.
The Confederate General Pickett, as in Pickett's Charge. And yes, satire is on the march. How to Dodge a Cannonball is, among other things, about the absurdity of the Civil War, as experienced by a 15-year-old from Illinois who seeks glory through flag twirling. Author Denard Dale is with us now to talk about it. Were you a flag twirler yourself at any point?
I only served briefly in the Civil War, but... Okay.
There are so many Civil War novels. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to write this one?
So it had a lot more to do with my own fixation than necessarily some kind of critique of the existing canon. Though, you know, most Civil War novels are written by serious people, so I think I bring something very unique on that term, this sort of catch-22 by way of the 1860s.
Talk to us about Anders, because he is this kind of Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn type character, and he's white, and that's like a big part of this.
So Anders' voice was kind of one of the main impetuses for me writing this. He is someone who has this... He has this narrow experience. He has these very tilted viewpoints coming at him. He's trying to sort this information. I mean, he is deluded, but the reason is he does not really have a better bank of information to work from. And then he is just thrown into the pool of the world, and he is essentially learning about the world, unfortunately, in the most active, bullet-ridden, high-risk way possible. You know, sometimes when you write comedy, it's nice to go with sort of a pure fool or a pure idiot. But with him, I tried to do someone who had a lot of strong sort of, I guess you'd say quantitative or mechanical intelligence, mm-hmm. but was just not equipped for the social maelstrom that he is being thrown into, especially at his age. He is convinced that his tiny slice of this war, you know, maintaining morale, performing for soldiers is the most important thing.
He takes it very seriously, and he is, like, very critical of others who try to do it.
Oh, yeah. His ego is wrapped all the way around this thing. In his head, he is the Mozart of spinning this flagpole around.
And it seems like Anders, his primary motivation at first is to survive. Because, you know, the thing about it is he twirls for the Union, then he switches sides, and he twirls for the Confederates. And then he switches back to twirl for the Union. But this time, he attaches himself to a black regiment. And then he goes around telling everyone he's an octoroon. None of the black soldiers really buy it, but they just kind of let him in. Why do you think they accept him?
So right off the bat, it is clear that this kid who has no idea what he's doing is a breed of misfit. And they are in this extremely unenviable position where they are being told they have to, you know, fight to earn or deserve their freedom. That's sort of an idea I interrogate throughout all this. And I think being in that position gives them a little more sympathy than they might have otherwise. And this one figure, Gleason, who he calls himself a scientific playwright, he's kind of a Jules Verne. It's very important that he meets Gleason first because he's someone who's a very true believer in America as pitched, in earning this place in America, that this is the moment for Black America, that it can all be okay from here. And that affects how he treats this kid who comes in, just runs in shouting, "Hi, I'm an octoroon," and he just sort of nods along like, yeah. Okay, I can work with this.
Anders also kind of unwittingly discovers this plot that's happening while the Civil War rages. And there's this showdown with a surprise bad guy, Wendy Ross, the daughter of Betsy Ross. It turns out she's a master flag twirler. Can you read a little bit from their flag twirling smackdown?
He started with a crouched walk the eagle, sweeping the pole under his foot and hopping over. Wendy matched it. She performed a varial flag spin. He matched it. Anders performed a Delaware crossing, spinning the pole on his left knee while imitating Washington's favorite pose.
Is this kind of like a, you know, you've been served type thing?
That is exactly the frame. I essentially took the type of movements you would do in breaking or b-boying, and I use a lot of sort of stylistic affectations or vocabulary style of skateboarding. Like, you know, it says varial flag spin.
Okay.
It's just like a game of skate, basically. And they have this whole ideological thing behind it because, I'll be careful of the spoilers, but she has a very particular, insane position that she is sort of pitching through the medium of this flag twirling thing at him. But she has a retro perspective on what the country is and where it should go. And it is kind of a thread that underlies a lot of the psychology of long-term politics in America. You can still sort of see it play out in very strange ways today, essentially this royalist streak. And Anders essentially has to come in and try to represent this sort of baseline sanity for the people that are, you know, living day to day here.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about Gleason's view that this was the moment? Because it wasn't the moment. It was a moment. It did end slavery, but it really wasn't the moment that Gleason was hoping it would be for Black people.
You know, it's one of the core tensions because you and I, sitting on the perch of history, which I have the convenience of writing this book from, we see the whole long road and the dogs and the sharecroppers and any given headline last week ahead. At the same time, there's this tension because you do, in a way, need these people that have this strive or the sort of purist belief to make whatever gains you make.
After kind of plumbing the aspects of American identity, you know, in writing this book, has your sense changed of whether a more perfect union is possible? Or are we, you know, kind of doomed to keep reliving this stuff?
So when I fell all the way into the rabbit hole of researching and preparing for this book, I think I was actually a little surprised by how, I don't know, everything, there's always like a sub-viewpoint or a sub-faction, like it's all very chaotic. And in a way, it was less samey than I expected. And I think that's a good reminder that this is a place of a relatively short history. These are not immutable things. I think that's half why a lot of us care or even bother, is that we sense that this is a nascent culture that is influenceable. I actually do believe that we can get far better or far worse. We are not necessarily on track for the status quo. Yeah.
That's Denard Dale. His new book is How to Dodge a Cannonball. Thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate this. This was a great conversation.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and have a happy Father's Day.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation. We'll be right back.
God, God.